In the meantime, we could make what preparations were possible and dry our clothes by taking advantage of every scrap of heat from the fires we lit for the cooking of our meals. We turned in early that night, and I remember that I dreamed of the great wave and aroused my companions with a shout of warning as I saw, with half-awakened eyes, the towering cliff on the opposite side of the cove. Shortly before midnight, a gale sprang up suddenly from the northeast with rain and sleet showers. It brought quantities of glacier ice into the cove, and by 2 a.m., May 12th, our little harbour was filled with ice, which surged to and fro in the swell and pushed its way onto the beach. We had solid rock beneath our feet and could watch without anxiety. When daylight came, rain was falling heavily, and the temperature was the highest we had experienced for many months. The icicles overhanging our cave were melting down in streams, and we had to move smartly when passing in and out, lest we should be struck by falling lumps. A fragment weighing 15 or 20 pounds crashed down while we were having breakfast. We found that a big hole had been burned in the bottom of Worsley's reindeer sleeping bag during the night. Worsley had been awakened by a burning sensation in his feet, and had asked the men near him if his bag was all right. They looked and could see nothing wrong. We were all superficially frostbitten about the feet, and this condition caused the extremities to burn painfully, while at the same time sensation was lost in the skin. Worsley thought that the uncomfortable heat of his feet was due to the frostbite, and he stayed in his bag and presently went to sleep again. He discovered, when he turned out in the morning, that the tussock grass which we had laid on the floor of the cave had smouldered outwards from the fire, and had actually burned a large hole in the bag beneath his feet. Fortunately, his feet were not harmed. Our party spent a quiet day, attending to clothing and gear, checking stores, eating and resting. Some more of the young albatrosses made a noble end in our pot. The birds were nesting on a small plateau above the right-hand end of our beach. We had previously discovered that when we were landing from the boat on the night of May 10th, we had lost the rudder. The James Caird had been bumping heavily astern as we were scrambling ashore, and evidently the rudder was then knocked off. A careful search of the beach and the rocks within our reach failed to reveal the missing article. This was a serious loss, even if the voyage to the head of the Sound could be made in good weather. At dusk, the ice in the cove was rearing and crashing on the beach. It had forced up a ridge of stones close to where the James Caird lay at the edge of the tussock grass. Some pieces of ice were driven right up to the canvas wall at the front of our cave. Fragments lodged within 2 feet of Vincent, who had the lowest sleeping place, and within 4 feet of our fire. Crean and McCarthy had brought down 6 more of the young albatrosses in the afternoon, so we were well supplied with fresh food. The air temperature that night probably was not lower than 38 or 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and we were rendered uncomfortable in our cramped sleeping quarters by the unaccustomed warmth. Our feelings towards our neighbours underwent a change. When the temperature was below 20 degrees Fahrenheit, we could not get too close to one another. Every man wanted to cuddle against his neighbour. But let the temperature rise a few degrees, and the warmth of another man's body ceased to be a blessing. The ice and the waves had a voice of menace that night, but I heard it only in my dreams. The bay was still filled with ice on the morning of Saturday, May 13th, but the tide took it all away in the afternoon. Then a strange thing happened. The rudder, with all the broad Atlantic to sail in and the coasts of 2 continents to search for a resting place, came bobbing back into our cove. With anxious eyes we watched it as it advanced, receded again, and then advanced once more, under the capricious influence of wind and wave. Nearer and nearer it came as we waited on the shore, oars in hand, and at last we were able to seize it. Surely a remarkable salvage. The day was bright and clear. Our clothes were drying, and our strength was returning. Running water made a musical sound down the tussock slope and among the boulders. We carried our blankets up the hill and tried to dry them in the breeze 300 feet above sea level. In the afternoon, we began to prepare the James Caird for the journey to the head of King Haakon Bay. A noon observation on this day gave our latitude as 54 degrees 10 minutes 47 seconds south. But according to the German chart, the position should have been 54 degrees 12 minutes south. Probably Worsley's observation was the more accurate. We were able to keep the fire alight until we went to sleep that night, for while climbing the rocks above the cove, I had seen at the foot of a cliff a broken spar which had been thrown up by the waves. We could reach this spa by climbing down the cliff, and with a reserve supply of fuel thus in sight, we could afford to burn the fragments of the James Caird's topsides more freely. During the morning of this day, May 13th, Worsley and I tramped across the hills in a northeasterly direction with the object of getting a view of the sound and possibly gathering some information that would be useful to us in the next stage of our journey. It was exhausting work, but after covering about 2.5 miles in 2 hours, we were able to look east up the bay. We could not see very much of the country that we would have to cross in order to reach the whaling station on the other side of the island. We had passed several brooks and frozen tarns, and at a point where we had to take to the beach on the shore of the sound, we found some wreckage, an 18-foot pine spar, probably part of a ship's topmast, several pieces of timber, and a little model of a ship's hull, evidently a child's toy. We wondered what tragedy that pitiful little plaything indicated. We encountered also some Gentoo penguins and a young sea elephant, which Worsley killed. When we got back to the cave at 3 p.m., tired, hungry, but rather pleased with ourselves, we found a splendid meal of stewed albatross chicken waiting for us. We had carried a quantity of blubber and the sea elephant's liver in our blouses, and we produced our treasures as a surprise for the men. Rough climbing on the way back to camp had nearly persuaded us to throw the stuff away, but we had held on, regardless of the condition of our already sorely trite clothing, and had our reward at the camp. The Long Bay had been a magnificent sight, even to eyes that had dwelt on grandeur long enough and were hungry for the simple, familiar things of everyday life. Its green-blue waters were being beaten to fury by the northwesterly gale. The mountains, stern peaks that dared the stars, peered through the mists, and between them huge glaciers poured down from the great ice slopes and fields that lay behind. We counted 12 glaciers and heard every few minutes the reverberating roar caused by masses of ice carving from the parent streams. On May 14th, we made our preparations for an early start on the following day, if the weather held fair. We expected to be able to pick up the remains of the sea elephant on our way up the sound. All hands were recovering from the chafing caused by our wet clothes during the boat journey. The insides of our legs had suffered severely, and for some time after landing in the cove, we found movement extremely uncomfortable. We paid our last visit to the nests of the albatrosses, which were situated on a little undulating plateau above the cave, amid tussocks, snow patches, and little frozen tarns. Each nest consisted of a mound over a foot high of tussock grass, roots, and a little earth. The albatross lays one egg, and very rarely two. The chicks, which are hatched in January, are fed on the nest by the parent birds for almost 7 months before they take to the sea and fend for themselves. Up to 4 months of age, the chicks are beautiful white masses of downy fluff, but when we arrived on the scene their plumage was almost complete. Very often one of the parent birds was on guard near the nest. We did not enjoy attacking these birds, but our hunger knew no law. They tasted so very good, and assisted our recuperation to such an extent that each time we killed one of them, we felt a little less remorseful. May 15th was a great day. We made our hoosh at 7:30 a.m., then we loaded up the boat and gave her a flying launch down the steep beach into the surf. Heavy rain had fallen in the night, and a gusty northwesterly wind was now blowing, with misty showers. The James Caird headed to the sea, as if anxious to face the battle of the waves once more. We passed through the narrow mouth of the cove with the ugly rocks and waving kelp close on either side, turned to the east, and sailed merrily up the bay as the sun broke through the mists and made the tossing waters sparkle around us. We were a curious-looking party on that bright morning, but we were feeling happy. We even broke into song, and, but for our Robinson Crusoe appearance, a casual observer might have taken us for a picnic party sailing in a Norwegian fjord or one of the beautiful sounds of the west coast of New Zealand. The wind blew fresh and strong, and a small sea broke on the coast as we advanced. The surf was sufficient to have endangered the boat if we had attempted to land where the carcass of the sea elephant was lying, so we decided to go on to the head of the bay without risking anything, particularly as we were likely to find sea elephants on the upper beaches. The big creatures have a habit of seeking peaceful quarters protected from the waves. We had hopes, too, of finding penguins. Our expectation, as far as the sea elephants were concerned, was not at fault. We heard the roar of the bulls as we neared the head of the bay, and soon afterwards saw the great unwieldy forms of the beasts lying on a shelving beach towards the bay head. We rounded a high glacier-worn bluff on the north side, and at 12:30 p.m. we ran the boat ashore on a low beach of sand and pebbles, with tussock growing above high water mark.